Welcome to my first session on morality, or more specifically, moral theology. I am Father Cody, and I'll be your host for this series. Now, one of the challenges we're going to face in the first five sessions of this series is that it feels like there's not a linear format to it, unlike most of the stuff that I do, which is in sequential format, and therefore you can follow easily from point to point. This one doesn't work that way. The better way to understand these first five sessions is to think of morality as a circle, and that what we're trying to do is poke at the middle of the circle. And yet to do that, we have to find all the points around it and how they interconnect to the central question that's at the middle of the circle, which is, how are we to act? What are we to do? And so this first one is titled Finding Moral Norms. It is probably the most foundational of all the sessions I will lead on this series, and yet the most challenging, because, as we're fairly well aware, we don't necessarily agree on which moral norms we follow. What is considered moral law? How do we find it? How do we live it? What is it? And so that's our first question. What is moral law? What are moral norms? Are they something that work for all times, peoples, and places? Or are they based on cultures? Are they based on people? Are they based on desires? What is it? Now, although this question may seem trivial, it is not. It is a very important question. It is something that philosophers have wrestled with since the beginning of human society. And so here we begin. What is right and wrong? What are we to do? Now, in order to find a moral norm, we have to address several questions. Does evil and good exist? Are there such things as right and wrong? And we have lots of different viewpoints on it, and I'm hoping that by the end of this session, you will basically have more tools to work with, more ways to understand people, and maybe some new ideas to play with as you wrestle with this question for yourself. So the first part of this series will focus on different ways of understanding moral norms. What is considered right and wrong? The first perspective on this is called subjectivity. It's a term that I made up, honestly. Anyway, subjectivity is about this idea that moral laws are subjective. They are based strictly on what people of a specific time, place, culture, circumstance believe is right and wrong. People who follow the subjectivist viewpoint say there are no moral norms. There is nothing that holds for all society, for all times, for all places. Everything is purely subjective. And to some extent, they have some good examples. Here's an example that could confuse us a little bit. In Western society, it is usually considered immoral to kill your children. In Eastern society, not so much. The higher moral norm is the care of elders or care of your parents. Therefore, if your parents are ill or aging and you don't have the funds to take care of them, it would be considered immoral for you to keep your children alive knowing that it costs you money when your parents are ailing. If you don't believe me, years ago I went to a Japanese art exhibit where this is one of the primary pieces on the exhibit. It told the story of this man who had just received his firstborn son. His wife was pregnant and gave birth. Knowing his parents were ill and knowing his duty to them, he killed his child. As he was burying his child in the backyard, he dug up a treasure chest full of tons of money and everything worked out at the end. Yay, happy story ending. This is the difference between the different societies of the world and why this question is so challenging. Subjectivists would point to that story and say, well, of course, for Eastern societies, this makes sense. Their moral norms are different than Western societies. They're not right or wrong. They're just right or wrong for those people of that time in that place. Another example, which is quite near to our current situation, is the issue of marijuana. For a long time, marijuana was considered illegal, and we as people of the Western world equate legality with morality, which I argue is very problematic. For marijuana being illegal, the main arguments were, it's a drug, and drugs are illegal, and therefore marijuana should be illegal. We looked at issues of health and brain function and all these different factors that contribute to its illegality. As things develop and we get more information, the new trend is, since marijuana isn't like the harder drugs, cocaine, heroin, narcotics, those, and it doesn't affect people in the same way, being chemically addictive, why shouldn't we allow people to use it if it makes them happy and brings benefits? One of the primary ones being medical benefits, alleviation of pain. With these new thoughts in mind, we changed our stance, and many of the states have already legalized not just medical marijuana, but recreational marijuana, under this understanding that since we have new information, we should not think of it in the same moral way that we did before, but now think of it as moral, or its use moral. These are a few examples that of the subjectivist mindset. There are no moral norms, they're just based on our times, and as long as we agree to what's right or wrong for that particular time, place, and culture, that is considered right and wrong. The second viewpoint, on the exact opposite spectrum from subjectivity, is absolutionists. Absolutionists believe that there are absolute moral norms. These moral norms fit for all people's times and places. They are not subject to change. They work for all people. And for some people, this has some credibility. There are certain things throughout all time and space and history that have held as true moral norms. Thou shalt not kill, as an example. It gets more nuanced, but for the most part, most societies believe the aspect of killing someone or the action of killing someone is wrong. Stealing is another one that's generally considered immoral. Adultery has largely held as something immoral for most cultures. And so in this way, as we scope across all of human history and the various societies and peoples, there are certain things that are just generally normative. For this reason, the absolutionist gains some credibility there. As the third viewpoint fits right in the middle between the two, and it addresses a few questions that the absolutionists have and a few questions the subjectivists have. This is called the proportionalists. Proportionalists believe that there is standard moral norms, but these moral norms are much more specific than absolute words. They are more about situations, more about actions, than they are about general statements. For example, the idea thou shalt not kill. The absolutionist would say, yes, that is a standard moral norm. The proportionalist would say, not quite. It's immoral to murder. And more specifically, it's immoral to murder an innocent person. Therefore, a soldier in battle would not be considered immoral in his actions because he shot the guy who was an opposing soldier. In this case, it's a sign of self-defense. Neither would a government who imposes capital punishment, namely the death penalty, be incurring an immoral action because that's not an innocent person. That's a person guilty of a crime. So in this way, the proportionalists take from the absolutionists that there are absolute moral norms. There are certain things that have held, but they need to be nuanced and heavily explained to make it clear what those moral norms are. Another example, thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not take things you do not absolutely need. You shall not take from another person given other means. Another example. But they also take from the subjectivist point of view, in that we can't just make absolutes, they have to be meshed in with the cultural climate slightly to understand how they apply in those contexts. So here we have three moral perspectives that help guide us as we work into the next chunk. The next chunk focuses on ethical frameworks, and these span the most common ones used throughout all of history. They help guide our attention to wander into the mystery of what it means to be moral, what kind of framework works. The first one comes from the Greek philosopher Aristotle, who lived in the 3rd century BC. He attempted to find a code that allows people to live well, and so as a philosopher and scientist, he strove to take reason and logic and mesh them into something that could be useful for all people, hence Aristotelian ethics. Aristotelian ethics is based on the notion of virtue. Virtues are right behaviors. More specifically, they are right actions performed at the right time in the right circumstance. Hear how specific that is. A virtue is not just good behavior. It's about performing well in a given circumstance, in a given situation, with a given person. That's how specific they need to be. Virtues fall between two extremes. On one extreme is always are vices. Both extremes have vices. I think it's important to start with an example. This is getting weird. Here's an example. Courage. Courage is considered a virtue. So the person who acts courageously or is willing to engage with the action would then do so in the right context, in the right place, with the right people and circumstances. The two extremes to courage would be timidity and foolhardy. These two extremes border the virtue of courage and give it more definition. The two extremes, timidity and foolhardy, are easy to explain. Timidity is when you do not act rightly in that you are too shy or too reserved when courage is necessary. Foolhardy is when you're too bold or expressive when courage dictates more prudence. So in this way, we can see courage as fitting between these two extremes of acting boldly and rightly with the right amount of courage for the given circumstance. Here are some examples. Let's say I'm a soldier in battle. Having been well trained and worked with my army, I am now the commander of the army. I see an opposing force of 20 people against my troop of 2,000 men. Seeing them, I freak out and say, "No, let's surrender now before anything happens." That would be timidity. Clearly, I not only have the training and expertise, but I also have more men than they do. Unless there's something I don't see that would cause me to realize I need to surrender, this would be acting timidly. After all my work, I back down. The other extreme would be, let's say I'm a commander of an army. I have 200 men going against 20,000 men. Having been trained and well-versed in this, I decide, "We can take them, let's go. 200 versus 20,000, we got this." Seems like we need some tactics here, not just rushing into battle. Hence, foolhardy. The true courage would come in the sense of, I am well trained, I have addressed my situation, I have prudently evaluated how I ought to act and what strategy I need to take, and have done that well. This is acting and living well. Aristotle used this method of virtue ethics to describe how everyone ought to live. He also claimed that if you didn't figure it out by the age of 35, there's nothing we could do. He didn't get everything right. Let me give another example. Here's the one. Generosity, or charity. They kind of work the same. Charity is giving the right amount and doing it well in a given circumstance. The two extremes are miserliness and self-harm. Miserliness is where we keep too much to ourselves and are not willing to give it. Self-harm is where we give so much of ourselves we don't have enough for our basic sustenance, and therefore we're harmed by it. Here's an example. So I see a guy who's begging for money on the street. If I glare at him and harass him, clearly I'm being miserly, thinking he needs to do more and he's not doing enough. On the same vein, if I saw that guy on the street and gave him my house and my car and my entire bank account, that would be self-harm. I've done a great deal of harm to myself for what good of generosity it would have been. But what is proper generosity? This is something many people wrestle with. Is giving money the proper way? Or is it giving food? This is what each person must address on their own. What is considered generous for me? How ought I to act in this particular situation? That is a challenge. And I think from both of these examples, it shows the challenges that come with virtue ethics. Virtue ethics is immensely personal. How ought I to act? Not how ought you to act. And for that reason, it's really hard to determine whether someone did act virtuously or not. There are some characteristics that help to make it clear, such as if they're like Mr. Scrooge and are hoarding tons of money, and there's people who are dying and need funds or basic food and sustenance, we can declare it miserliness. But the true middle ground, the true virtue, is much more challenging, because for that person, it may be different than the next person. And how do we adjudicate that difference between peoples? How do we adjudicate the difference between circumstances and situations? This is the challenge. And so although virtue ethics has a beauty to it, and that it's practical and easy to use, it also has a challenge in that we have to constantly use it. There are no moral norms. There are generally assumed things, the virtues, but beyond that, everyone must act as he or she declares prudent, and he or she must act according to what is right for that circumstance, time, place, and peoples. The second system, deontological ethics. Deontological ethics was coined by Immanuel Kant, an 19th century German philosopher who desired to have a system with no loopholes. He wanted a system that fit for all times, peoples, places, and cultures. There are moral absolutes. He figured if there were moral absolutes, principles we can directly isolate as the moral law, then we can easily determine whether someone broke it and how we ought to live. It's very simple. This system's brilliant in that if we went to the court system or we're challenging a friend, you can easily say, this is the law, it was broken, end of discussion. Or with like virtue ethics, you can't do that. You have to assume the person must work to act rightly. His system is also rather simple. If I can use reason to reason up to a moral principle, then the moral principle is not based on human intuition or human reasoning, but based on reason itself, and therefore holds for all times, peoples, cultures, and places. Here's an example. I'm walking down the street, and I see a guy stab another guy. He murdered him. The guy that stabbed him has not only killed that other guy, but has harmed his entire family, who has built relationships around him. They have caused him suffering, distress, sadness at his loss, and maybe if he had young kids, the source of sustenance for those kids. And all the friends and relatives and people that guy knew is now harmed by this act of killing. The murderer himself is now affected too, because everyone thinks of him as a murderer. He's now more inclined to disrespect the dignity of life, the dignity of other people, and to treat them as he wants. And therefore, not only is the guy who's dead affected, but the murderer himself has been affected by this crime, and his family, who now has to deal with the fact that they have a murderer in their family. Therefore, murder is immoral. More specifically, all forms of killing are immoral. Thou shall not kill. Here's another example. Theft. If I take something from a shop, let's say I'm going to take a loaf of bread from the shop. By doing so, I devalue the shop owner who is working for his own living and working hard at it by saying I can take from you whatever I want. Therefore, not only do I harm myself by treating other people as objects of my use and other people's things as my own, but I'm also devaluing that person who has worked hard and is working towards his own living. This breaks down if everyone starts to steal from each other and causes social problems. Therefore, theft is immoral in all circumstances, times, and places. Let's throw some examples in there. Counterexamples. The first one I want to use is from the movie book Les Miserables. This is a central question of that book. Is it immoral to steal? More importantly, is it immoral to steal in order to provide for a starving family? Jean-Paul Jean was a theft who took a loaf of bread to feed his starving family. He felt he did rightly because the value of life is greater than the value of stealing, and therefore he needs to protect his children from starvation when there are no other means. Javert, who is the police officer, argues that no, there are specific moral norms who hold for all times, peoples, and places. Therefore, he cannot steal and needs to be judged accordingly. This is the contrast. Who is right? According to Kant, Javert is correct because Jean Valjean stole, and that is immoral and illegal. Here's the classic example for a counterexample for deontological ethics. Let's say I'm in the 20th century Germany, and a German soldier comes to my door and knocks. I open the door. He asks me, "Are you hiding Jews in your basement?" What am I to do? According to Immanuel Kant, I cannot lie, or I can't even deceive. I must tell the truth, because the truth is the only moral option. And therefore I tell them, Why, yes, I am hiding Jews in my basement. Did I act rightly? Depending on who you ask, they go many different directions. Those who are not proponents of Kant and would like to dismiss his theory would say, of course you should lie. The value of life is greater than the value of lying. You need to preserve these people's lives, and therefore Kant's ethical system does not work. It does not apply in circumstances like this, where truly evil means are being made. Those who are more proponents of Kant and want to support his theory would argue that the immoral action is not up to me. I choose how I act, and how I act determines my moral status. By not lying, I have done what is right. I cannot determine what the soldiers will do, neither will my actions truly affect them. I must choose what is right for myself and live a true moral life on my own, not worrying about other people's actions. Nevertheless, I think you see both the value and the challenges of the deontological system. Its beauty is its simplicity. If you can reason to it, and everyone agrees to the reasoning that led to that action being immoral or moral, so be it. You can adjudicate for all peoples and every time and place what is right and wrong, and make it very clear, black and white, done. Yet, the system doesn't quite fit the challenges we face in human society, and therefore, that's its limitation. The last system I have is called utilitarianism. It was developed by two philosophers, Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, in the 20th century. Their goal was to find a morality or moral system that would actually work well in the plethora of cultures and times that we're in, so that we could figure out how to act rightly, given the complexities of the modern world. Their system is based on utility, hence utilitarianism. It's very simple. Utilitarian calculus works like this. You take a moral action, and you add up the amount of happiness that would be produced from that action, and the amount of unhappiness that would be produced from that action, and if the happiness is greater than the unhappiness, it is a moral decision, and you must do it. If the amount of unhappiness is greater than the amount of happiness, then it is immoral, and you should not do it. That's it. Now, there's a lot of challenges here, and I want to be very honest about the challenges, but also try to work within this system. The first and most glaring challenge is, what do we mean by happiness? And by the way, they do not say good, and they do not say goodness. It is truly happiness. What makes people happy? And it's not a collective idea of happiness, like if five people are happy and two unhappy, that works. It's the sheer amount of happiness. So if three people were immensely happy by the action, and 10 people were slightly unhappy, then the three people would outweigh the 10 unhappy people because their amount of happiness is greater. It's about sheer amount. What leads to greater happiness? In the same way, we have to be careful with our group. Because I can say in my family, the four of us, two of us may be really happy and two of us might not be very happy at all, and therefore in that group, that situation would be moral. Then I can expand it. What about my town? What about my state? What about my country? What about the world? This entire system is based on clearly defining terms. Who is the population? Who are the people affected? What is happiness? What is unhappiness? How do you understand the amount? And I need to be clear, this is not democracy. It's not a voting system. We don't just raise our hands and say, we're all happy, we're all unhappy, cool, 6-4, good, moral. No. One person can decide as a person what everyone else ought to do, because it's moral reasoning to happiness, not just sheer feeling. That's the big challenge. So once we understand what is meant by happiness and unhappiness, who we define as a group, then even one person alone can go through and use this system to find out whether that action is considered moral or immoral. To help explain this, even though it's fairly simple on its own, I do want to use the example my professor gave in college. It's a gruesome example. if we decided as a culture that eating babies was the thing that brought us the greatest happiness. For whatever reason, we like baby meat. It's absolutely disturbing to me. It disturbed the whole class, but he got his point across. If we decided that baby meat brought us the greatest happiness as a culture, then it would be moral for us to eat babies. Okay, let's use a not-so-gruesome example. Let me go back to the one about Japanese culture that I used at the beginning of this. So, in Japanese culture, and even Chinese and most Asian cultures, elders are considered important, with much greater importance than Western culture, to the point where care of our elders and care of our parents and grandparents is the prime action we ought to do, beyond even our own care. And therefore, in that culture, happiness is determined by the happiness of the elders, not my personal happiness. Therefore, the amount of happiness caused by them outweighs my own unhappiness, and therefore anything that is useful for them or good to them is more important and more moral than anything that's good or useful to me. In Western culture, it's the other way around, especially now. We are more inclined to desire our own good and strive for our own happiness than it would be our elders. And therefore, whatever is important or good to me brings me more happiness and culturally more happiness than what happens to our elders. The question is, if we expand that to the world, what would be the overall happiness, unhappiness? I am not doing that math. It sounds complicated. But now you see a little bit of how this works. Another prime example, which I did use already once before, is marijuana. In the last round of voting, for pretty much all the states that legalized marijuana, the main proponents claimed the following. Marijuana brings a great amount of happiness to those who use it. They can use it medically to treat pain and other conditions. Similarly, they have a way to recreational use a safe drug. The main antagonist to it said that it's just a drug. But largely people voted with the side of, well, they're using it, it doesn't affect me, so since their happiness is greater than mine, I might as well let them use it. Utilitarianism at its finest. And so in that example of marijuana, you can see how utilitarianism has worked and how we use it in our society to make very simple decisions about what's right and wrong, how we ought to vote, who ought to do what, and largely just look at happiness. What brings happiness to people? The last system I want to use for this session is very challenging but yet very important for at least me and for probably many of you who are listening to this, and that is religious ethics. Religious ethics is very tricky. Not only is religious ethics based on a system that has moral absolutes, but it's also usually in a system that cannot change. Most religiously based ethical systems have two fundamental principles behind them. That there are moral laws, and these moral laws come from a divine being who is unchangeable and whose laws are unchangeable. Which can cause issues. It can cause issues when cultures develop, but the laws don't. Do we keep the old laws? Do we need to re-see them in a new light? What do we do? I don't really need to explain further what these look like because most of us know to some extent what religious law looks like. I do want to explain around it, however. So one of the big issues we have, especially in modern culture, is when religiously based ethical systems confront modern ethical systems or modern peoples. Because for a lot of times, they do butt heads, or they challenge each other. For most religiously based ethical systems, there's no amount of social pressure will change the ethical system. We can't say to Islam, change your laws, they don't work for us. The only way that religious laws get updated, changed, or re-understood is within the religion itself. That the people at the highest points reflect on religious law and try to understand basic things, such as, what did our God intend? What do the laws mean? How do they apply today? Judaism is a wonderful example of this, as the rabbis debated for centuries how one ought to follow Jewish law. And they go so far as to say that God does not repeat himself, Therefore, when a law repeats itself in the books of law, then we must understand them in all context. Hence, the prohibition about doing work on the Sabbath became very complicated. At first, it was, you are to do no manual labor. And as things developed and they explained it further, it became, you cannot do any work whatsoever. That includes such things as signing your name on documents, lighting a fire to cook with. Meals had to be prepared in advance for the Sabbath and eaten cold. You cannot drive, and you cannot walk more than 100 steps. As Judaism continued to develop into the Common Era, it also updated these things to be more practical or useful. And each of the different sects of Judaism has found its own expression and meaning as they reflect on what does it mean that thou shalt not do work on the Sabbath. In Christianity, this becomes even more complicated, because the big question many people ask are, why don't we follow the Jewish law? Why don't we live the prohibitions of the Torah? Why are we not like the Jews? Some of the very common ones include pork. Why do Christians eat pork, but Jews do not? Why do Jews have very strict purity laws, which the Christians do not? Why do Jews sacrifice or read Torah so frequently when Christians do not? The answer comes in the updating and re-understanding of law. Why do we need purity laws when we have been purified by the blood of Jesus? Why do we need dietary restrictions when they clearly were meant to lead to obedience for the Jewish people, and now Jesus is our obedience, who has purified all foods and made them ready to eat? Why would we follow some of the codes of the Old Testament when they're meant for that time period, but Christianity is seen in a different time period? These are examples of updating or changing of religious law. Another example, which is a little more tricky but useful, is slavery. Many times throughout Scripture, slavery is mentioned. In the Old Testament, it's just there. In the New Testament, it's mentioned in passing as situations between slaves and masters arose. St. Paul, commenting on this, states that slavery is immoral, but he doesn't state it explicitly, because the Roman government was based on slavery, and so doing so would make him an enemy of the state. Instead, he took Christian principles and applied it in such a way to show his dislike or his thought of it being immoral. Namely, Christian slave owners need to treat their slaves as people with dignity and respect. Slaves need to treat their owners with dignity and respect. They must work knowing that they are brothers in the Lord and that they are meant to have the same dignity and respect. Although the church remained quite silent on slavery for many years, just addressing it as basically immoral, the more prominent stance came in the 19th century. In which the same question was arisen when we reached the Americas. As Spain began its colonization of Meso and South America, the question arose, are these people truly human or not? Since the colonization of Africa led to a very different response, we must ask what changed. Two priests were evaluating and working with the natives of the Americas, and they realized they have all the same characteristics we'd assume as a human being. Therefore, they wrote extensively to Rome, encouraging very strongly that the Pope declare all the people in the Americas human and protected under human sanctity, and therefore could not be enslaved. It worked. The Pope did make a declaration about the immorality of slavery, the value of the human person, and denounced slavery as a moral statement. Doing so made it so that the Americas was not enslaved like much of Africa. Oh, if only it had been a couple centuries earlier, whole human history would have changed. The advantage of a religiously based ethical system is it's not our laws. So many of the moral systems we see today are based on our reasoning, or our desires, or our hopes and dreams. Where religiously based ethical systems are based on a divine being who gives law. Someone beyond humanity, someone who sees the whole framework of the universe and sees law at its core. Although they are challenging to work with, and even more challenging to update or refine, they do have that foundational starting point of immutable laws. which can be helpful. We can easily point to someone and say, you did that wrong. Or to another person, good job, you did that right. Although it didn't sound like I came up with a conclusion, which I really didn't, I hope you can play with these ideas and decide where you fit into the system. What do we hope for morality? Do we want a moral law that holds for all people's times and places, makes it easy to know what's right and wrong and what we ought to do? Or do we want to do whatever we want and allow our moral systems to ebb and flow with the changing of times and seasons so that we can do whatever we want and feel good about it in the current age? Largely, for the rest of this series, I will be assuming there are moral norms. Without them, we cannot proceed. We must assume that certain things are wrong and will always be wrong, and although I may not justify them like you wish, they are still going to be considered immoral, and we can build more language about how one ought to act, what is considered right and wrong, and more importantly, how we ought to live. From using these moral principles, letting them guide us into deeper reflection, and then working at culpability, morality, and right living.